The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to Backstory. Let's hear it on WTBR-FM Pittsfield with Roberta McCulloch-Dews. Thanks for tuning in. So if you tuned into the last week's podcast, you would have heard that I had as my guest, Dr. Frances Jones-Sneed, who she just has a litany of accolades behind her name. But for those who don't know, she is a professor emeritus of history at Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. She's the co-director of the Upper Housatonic Valley African American Heritage Trail. She was a 2008 NEH Fellow at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute at Harvard University and a 2022 recipient of the Massachusetts Governor's Award in the Humanities. And it was important to have a part two because we had a great part one. And part one, we got into her background growing up all the way back in Mississippi, in her small town, and taking us from those beginnings all the way through her trajectory, her academic journey, as well as to where she currently stands now, right? And so showing us that with all great positions, there's always a beginning. And we got into talking about W.E.B. Du Bois. We didn't get too much into it because we ran out of time. And I promised Dr. Jones-Sneed we'd have a part two. And I wanted to keep my word. And so today's conversation is going to be dedicated to the history in the Berkshires, the Black history in the Berkshires, because that is something that Dr. Jones-Sneed specializes in when it comes to history and finding out about people in different pockets of the communities that she lives in. So Dr. Jones-Sneed, it's a pleasure to welcome you again.
Thank you so much, Roberta. And we know that the history of Blacks in the Berkshires that a group of us have been working on for 20 plus years now is so important to me. And a history that I think is important to anybody who lives in the Berkshires, and especially young people who are now coming up in the Berkshires, to know the history that's right on the ground. I think I said before, local history is such an important aspect of history to me because it really shows that history is important, that you can start from the local area and you can understand how it then spans to a regional and a kind of national kind of level. And just talking about what we looked at is that we said that we had five anchor sites of African-American history in Berkshire County. And of course, we started with Elizabeth Freeman and her fight for freedom before the Constitution of Massachusetts was ratified, and even before the Constitution of the United States was ratified. So we can see that African-Americans were in this county from the very beginning. And I think that is an important aspect to understand. Berkshire County was the last county settled in Massachusetts, what was then Massachusetts, Maine. We didn't also, part of it was in, kind of New York State until it was kind of ratified. And it was the last part because it was kind of a wilderness to everybody. I mean, it was hilly. It was not great for farming. It was kind of an outlier. And so people who came in were really kind of pioneers. And the first people who came in to Berkshire County as African-Americans were people like W.E.B. Du Bois's ancestors who had Dutch owners who came over from New York's state into this area. And it was the very first places that were settled by Europeans and Africans was the Southern Berkshires, which was Great Barrington, in that area. And so that's the way that we get Elizabeth Freeman. And so Elizabeth Freeman, we talk about as the first kind of anchor that we talk about, and we can talk about enslavement because we don't really talk about enslavement in New England a whole lot. And so we really kind of get to that story by talking about Elizabeth Freeman and her just bravery, that here's a woman who could not read, could not write, who was enslaved as a youngster. And what she did is that she kind of decided by just listening in at the table while she was serving, she heard the kind of resolves that were similar to the Declaration of Independence that said all men are created equal. And so she said to herself, I'm a human being, and so why shouldn't I be free? And so she marched, 4 miles from the home that she was enslaved in into Sheffield. She was actually in Ashley Falls. She marched 4 miles in order to find herself a lawyer who would, put her case in front of the court.
So,
And,
but Dr. Johnson, I got to ask you something about that though, because we hear that today and we think, wow, what bravery. But can we unpack that a little bit? Because when we think about the time, when we think about the environment that Elizabeth Freeman lived in, where did she get that gumption from to march herself 4 miles to Sheffield to do this? That was, I mean, we use bravery and we use those words very loosely nowadays, but could you talk a little bit more about her sense of agency and how that came to be? Because to me, that seems like a very, very powerful act of self-agency.
Oh, it certainly does, and it speaks to her humanity in that her slave owners, especially Mrs. Ashley, who treated her very, very harshly. Freeman must have said, I'm a human being, and sometimes, when you push somebody's against the wall and they don't have anything else to lose, you have to fight back. You don't give up, and we have stories after stories in African American history of that. Of course, that's the reason why we get Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman. And so here's our woman, Elizabeth Freeman, who has, we don't know where she gets this kind of resolve, but she does it in other kind of ways. And just to say, I am not a animal, I'm a human being, and I know that I have a right to this freedom. That grit, that is a story in African American history that is just universal, that comes no matter where African Americans were enslaved, you hear those kind of stories. And Elizabeth Freeman, she just had enough of it. And so she said, I'm gonna try this. And she did. And it's amazing that not only did she try it, she brought one of the males in the household with her, because Colonel Ashley, in the house that she was enslaved in the Ashley house, he had seven other slaves as well. And so she needed a male because the courts would not bring a case with a female plaintiff, so she had to have a male. So she Cedric, Charles Cedric, who took the case, found a male slave in the Ashley house. His name was Brom. That's all we know about it. And he is kind of lost to history because Brom was a part of the case, won his freedom, and then he disappears from the historical record. So we don't know whether he left the Berkshires and changed his name or what. We don't know what happened to him, but he also won his freedom. We are lucky that Elizabeth Freeman decided to stay in the Berkshires and make this her home in that kind of way. So, yeah. And of course, go ahead, I'm sorry.
The sheer courage, right? Because I think when we think about sometimes the North, we think that it was always everyone had like maybe that same sort of mindset and maybe abolitionist thought about them, but that wasn't always the case. And you didn't know quite who to trust, right? And you didn't know if sharing this message to someone that maybe could have said, you know what, I'm not going to support you. And in fact, that it could have led her into even greater trouble. But she took a chance. And she did something that is forever marked in history, where we are still calling her name.
We're still calling her name, and we're still dealing with some of the same agencies that she is kind of fought against. We still have discrimination within our midst, and so based on race and class and gender and religion, we still have that within the American society. And here is Elizabeth Freeman starting right at the start of the nation, right at the start of the nation, saying, I want my freedom. Because if you were talking about, if white men were talking about their freedom, why shouldn't you, I talk about my freedom at this point in time, you know? So, I mean, she has something that my grandmother called mother wit, or, this is something that, you cannot, get a degree in,
You're
it's
born with
something.
it.
You were born with this. So she was born with this natural talent to be able to read people, to read circumstances and that kind of thing. So she was a brilliant woman. She was such a smart woman to realize, that this was the end for her to talk about her freedom in this kind of way. She didn't need a PhD to decide that this was what she wanted to do, And so that's the reason why, we need to still celebrate this woman and to learn from her actions. Our actions should be even greater, because she had her life to lose, She could have lost her life in order to, and doing what she did, but she put her life on the line to say, I'm gonna find out about this, and I'm gonna deal with this, so.
You're right. You're absolutely right, Dr. Jones-Snead. I think that it's very easy, as the years progress and as names become enshrined in history, that sometimes you lose sight of the heaviness and the weight of what they actually accomplished at a time when there were no systems to protect them. And it was purely someone saying, I'm going to do this and I'm going to stand up for myself. And so I think, that it's a pleasure and a privilege to have people in history who have shown that strong resilience. And I think we can learn a lot from them, to show that, even in the midst of really, really hard situations, that there's still power in that self-agency. I want to ask a question about Agrippa Hull, because I think there was some news in the there was he was mentioned recently, I think, that there was some information. I want to say his papers were we now have his papers, discharge papers, I believe, right? And so the big, I want to say the big, not controversy, but the story around that was that he almost, so I think he didn't want to turn in the papers. And he viewed them kind of like as a keepsake because they were from Washington. So these papers meant a lot to him. For those who do not know, Agrippa Hall goes even way before Elizabeth Freeman. He's back in the American Revolution days, right? Or are they contemporaries?
He actually was one of the black men who served in the American Revolutionary War. And Agrippa Hull and his family were free. They were not enslaved. Agrippa was born in the Amherst area, and supposedly his mother and father worked for one of the presidents, like President Grant, it is told. I mean, this is a kind of local lore that they served as kind of cooks in the kitchen of the White House of the Grant administration. But anyway, he was born in Amherst, Massachusetts, and when he was in Amherst, his father died, and his mom was left alone, and so she decided that she was going to send Agrippa to friends in the Berkshires, another free Black family that had a farm right on the Housatonic River, to be there while she tried to, make some kind of living for herself. She eventually joined him. But when Agrippa came to Stockbridge, because this family had a farm right on the Housatonic, when he came to Stockbridge, Stockbridge was still a kind of a frontier town with Native Americans as well as whites there, and just a very few African Americans, So it was a really interesting time to be Black and in the Berkshires, because he grew up playing with some of his best friends were the Native Americans who lived in that area, And so when he got to be the age of 18, he decided that he wanted to, fight for the country, and so he enlisted. But with a lot of African American men who joined, it's going to be like the African American men who joined in the Civil War and all the way through to the Korean War. They were not seen as fit for battle necessarily, and so they were given kind of quote unquote grunt work, cooking, cleaning, dealing latrines and stuff like that. So Agrippa was actually what is described as an aide-de-camp, or a valet, really, is what he was to Thaddeus Kosciuszko, who was a Polish general who came over to help George Washington fight in the Revolutionary War. And he fought, he was with Kosciuszko, one other general whose name I can't remember. And then finally with Kosciuszko, he was with Kosciuszko mostly the entire time. He was in the entire length of the Revolutionary War. So he saw everything. And this Polish general actually fell in love with Agrippa Hull, because Agrippa was known as a storyteller, and that he could tell all of these wonderful, wonderful stories. And one of the stories that they tell about Agrippa when he was in the Revolutionary War is that when the general was out, he put on the general's clothes and was mimicking the general, pretending he was a general, and everybody was laughing and laughing, and then everybody stopped because the general walked in and saw Agrippa in his get up, and said, "What are you doing?" But it kind of endeared him to Agrippa Hull. And the wonderful story is that Thaddeus Kosciuszko was also a great friend of Thomas Jefferson, and he was an abolitionist in his right, Kosciuszko. Because, and I think he was because of his relationship with Agrippa Hull. He left after leaving the Revolutionary War. He goes back to Poland because they are fighting a revolution there. Well, he leaves in his will enough money for Jefferson to free all his slaves. Jefferson never does this, but it just shows, his thoughts. He comes back to the United States before his death, and he sends word to Agrippa, and they meet again. I mean, that's how much, he really kind of liked this man. And then Agrippa Hull, again, brilliant man, comes back to Stockbridge, works for the Sedgwick family. He is a valet in the house of the Sedgwicks, and he's there with Elizabeth Freeman. Elizabeth Freeman's there taking care of the kids and taking care of the household, and he's there as the valet. So they work in the house together. But he starts to buy property and becomes the largest Black landowner in Berkshire County. So this man was, this man was shrewd and sharp, to say, hey, what I should do is start buying myself some property, and doing these kinds of things. He and his wife were members of the Congregational Church. They were, resolute members of the church. He was well known in the Stockbridge area. Here we have, these two brilliant people, and then he's the one who eventually helps Elizabeth Freeman buy land, because she buys land right next to his home place in Stockbridge. And I think that we located exactly where it is. And Agrippa Hull's house has just been restored. And so somebody came in and bought his old home and restored that old home. And right next door, there's land that we think that was Elizabeth Freeman's home when she finally left the Sedgwicks. She was 30 in her 30s when she got her freedom. She lives 50 more years, as a free woman. So, I mean, that is just kind of really kind of fantastic. And so those two stories of Agrippa and Elizabeth Freeman are just, stories that can be, should be shared, because it's like, how did they do that back
See,
in
that's the
the
thing. First of all, I mean, to have that. You painted a wonderful picture in my head, and I think to myself, how big was the? So we have there was obviously Elizabeth Freeman was a member of the enslaved community here, but Agrippa Hall was he was free. He was never enslaved.
He was
How
never in
big was the free Black community here, and what was the interaction between the free Black community and the enslaved Black community?
I think that there was a free interaction between, because they were so small. Again, even today there's only about 3% of the population in the Berkshires are of African descent. And that number has not increased a whole lot. There were more Blacks in Sheffield, Great Barrington, and stock in the Stockbridge area. I mean, that's where they were mostly, centered at that point in time during Agrippa's and Elizabeth Freeman's time. It's going to grow, go north, of course, with Pittsfield, and then and lastly, North Adams, Williamstown area, is going to be populated. But that was the center. And I think I looked at it, and I think it was less than like 500 people, and that was a very, very small population. And talking about enslaved people, it's like in the Ashley's household, they had seven enslaved people. Sedgwick also had enslaved people as well. But
Lawyer for Elizabeth Freeman.
the lawyer for
Oh,
Elizabeth Freeman also had enslaved people. So there
okay.
were only, but there were, yes. But there were only two or three. But after Freeman's case, of course, slavery was abolished, in Massachusetts. I think that what I call it, because I'm a Southerner, I think that there was a period of a kind of Jim Crowism, in that Blacks, although they were free after that, they had a difficult time finding employment, housing, those kinds of things. And so they were still tied to the white patriarchy, even though they were free. And that's the reason why Elizabeth Freeman worked such a long time in the Ashley household. She was being paid to do that. She was also a midwife to the community, so she made her money like that. But I think that Agrippa taught her a lesson. She saved her pennies, and so that's the reason how she was She could buy her land, you know, because she's been saving these pennies, and she had these children, grandchildren, and great grandchildren,
Yeah.
and it's wonderful just to look at her will, and
Yeah.
she knew exactly what she wanted, you know, that she left an estate that today would be, you know, I don't know what it would be valued at today, but it was a substantial amount, land, money, and other kind of goods that she left to her children and grandchildren. It was amazing. So
When we think about her ability to do that, and even Agrippa Hall's ability to buy all this property and land, again, I go back to there's a self-agency, but then there's also the wider community. Was there a like did was he able to just go and say, I want to buy X amount of property, or I want to buy this land? Did he have to have an intercessor or someone go on his behalf to do it? Was the community, the banking system, the system of properties, did it allow for whether you were enslaved or even worked like an Elizabeth Freeman who had finally become free and then save up all this money? Was she able to even be a part of that banking system, or did she have to sort of save her money in her house and have
yes,
her pennies that way?
I think she saved her money in the house. I don't think that there was any kind of traditional banking systems that they used, you know, but and they, like the white society at that point in time, they put their money under the mattresses, right? So I think she bought her property, you know, quote unquote, for cash, because Agrippa was connected with the Congregational Church, because he was connected with the Sedgwicks, because he had such a national reputation, you know, a link to the Revolutionary War and everything like that. I think that the whites in the Stockbridge society, you know, really helped him out. I mean, he was a person that everybody knew. All the whites knew exactly who he was. He held court right there on Main Street, across from the Red Lion Inn, you know, sitting down. He would hold court telling his stories and things like that. So I think that they wanted to be helpful to him, you know, to gain whatever he
Yeah.
wanted to gain. And as I said, I think it was him who helped Elizabeth Freeman secure her property. So it was his name that,
Yeah.
you know, kind of got, you know, she was working for the Sedgwick, and I'm sure the Sedgwicks would sign off on it and everything. But, you know, Agrippa had already had land, you know, years and years before, Elizabeth even thought about, you know, buying property and stuff. So I
So
think it was,
he was a patriot then.
yes, he was a patriot and a patron, you know, to Freeman, and I think it to other Blacks in the community as well, you know. The largest Black land owner in the Berkshires, you know, that means that others probably were coming to him for loans and advice and all of that kind of stuff. So
So he
he was
wielded social capital, actual capital, all of that. And when you say he held court across from the Red Lion Inn, what did that look like back then? Was it like a town square or
It
something,
was
or?
like a t it was a town square, and it's where people congregated, you know, on, you know, Saturdays or market days and things like that. And so it was not as large as it is now. And so everybody congregated, you know, in those areas. And so that's the reason why he kind of knew everyone, you know. And a lot of them were farmers, you know, in that way. So but everybody kind of knew who he was, because the most of the population also, congregated at the church where he was, where he held an office in the church, he and his wife. Just a very well-known kind of person, you know. So it's just kind of amazing. And if you see his portrait, with the morning coat and, you know, the cane, and, you know, so he was a dapper guy as well, you know, so.
I love it, Dr. Jones, and I mean, I just revel in history, and I in the fact that, again, the stories folks doing amazing things at a time when we can't fathom that, right? I just want to, for my listeners just tuning in, my guest today is Dr. Frances Jones Sneed. She is Professor Emeritus of History at Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. She's also the co-director of the Upper Housatonic Valley African American Heritage Trail. And we're going to take a short break and we're going to be right back.
Whoa, like what exactly is happening here?
89.7 WTBR FM. Pittsfield.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs. Greylock Federal, opportunity grows here, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
We all know WTBR is great to listen to on 89.7 FM, but did you know that you can listen to WTBR just about anywhere? We've got a web stream and it's easy to use. Go to WTBRFM.com on your computer and click play. You can use the TuneIn app on your smartphone and connect it to your car's sound system. Or you can use your smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, play WTBRFM, and there's your community radio station. WTBR, for the love of radio.
This is Kevin Cahill from the Sunday Sounds of Ireland show, which you can listen to every Sunday on WTBR 89.7 at 10 a.m. You will hear the jigs, you will hear the reels, the fiddles, the bowrons, and the bagpipes, Paddy Riley, the Wolf Tones, the Chieftains, and even some cranberries. So listen to the Sunday Sounds of Ireland every Sunday at 10 a.m. here at WTBR 89.7.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back, WTBR.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Again, my guest today is Dr. Frances Jones Sneed. And we were just getting into some Revolutionary War kind of history. We're talking about Agrippa Hall. We're also talking about Elizabeth Freeman. I feel like those are like the titans, right? When we think about names that really carry the weight in the Berkshires, those are the titans. So let's continue to move down the history path. Who would you say is the next name that people should know?
Samuel Harrison, of course, the Reverend Samuel Harrison. And then this brings up to the central portion of the county in Pittsfield. Reverend Harrison was born, he was enslaved and he was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. His parents were actually from Georgia, and his mother happened to have been traveling with her enslavers. And that's the reason why Harrison was born in Philadelphia. But Philadelphia and New York and places like that allowed enslavers to bring their slaves in. And it was written on the books, if they didn't stay over maybe a 6 month period of time, then, you know, they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't deal with whether you were enslaved or free. But if you've read any kind of books, some enslaved people use that as an excuse to then, you know, kind of leave their enslavers, you know, to find freedom in these places. But Harrison and his mother were sent back to Savannah, Georgia. And they were owned by the Boltons family, who was a very large plantation owners in Savannah at that point in time. They came back to New York City to work for another family of the Boltons. Harrison, in his autobiography, said that his family was freed, and that's the reason why they came back to New York. But when I look at the 1820 census, that was not true, because looking at the household that they were in, the people who were in that household are listed as enslaved. The 1820 census, there's a slave census, but they don't give anybody's name. They give gender and they give age. And so just by the gender and age, I see that Harrison and his mother are in that household. He leaves in 1827 to join an uncle in Philadelphia. And it's just so happened in 1827 is when New York abolishes slavery. So so it just kind of fits in that kind of way. But then he stays and he becomes an apprentice to his uncle as a cobbler. Then he gets kind of his call to Damascus, you know, he gets his Macedonian call, he calls it, and decides that he wants to be a minister. And so he goes off to seek education. He goes all the way to Pennsylvania and finally stays there for 2.5 years, first in New York, to a school in New York, by a man named Gerrit Smith, who was an abolitionist. He was on there for about 6 months. That school closes down, and then he goes to Pennsylvania. He goes to Ohio to this next school. He stays there for 2.5 years, finally comes back to Philadelphia, marries, and opens up himself a cobbler shop. But he still wants to, you know, be a minister. And so he and his wife and then two or three children then go to New Jersey because he has a friend there. Mm-hmm. And he goes there and he gets a church there. Still hasn't been ordained. And so he's looking for that kind of ordination. While he's in New Jersey, his friend hears about an opening in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, because a group of Black people who were members of the First Congregational Church in Pittsfield decide that they're going to separate from that church because they can't take communion with the rest of the congregation. And so they decide that they're going to form their own church. And so they're looking for a minister. And so he comes, does his initial...
How did he, but I'm always fascinated by when folks say, and they heard about this, especially at a time when, I mean, like, it's not like they could just pick up the phone and call. So what was the network of communication back then for Reverend Harrison at, who was Samuel at the time, just to hear about this? How did that news travel within the communities?
The news had to travel via letter, you know, and, you know, black folks just know each other, right? I mean, if there is a Black folks within 20 miles, you're going to know that you have to get to know that, you know, I saw somebody. And so this man who was his friend in New Jersey knew about these people, knew a friend in Pittsfield, and they wrote to him saying, we are looking for a minister. Do you know someone? And I said, oh, I know the very person who may be really good for you, you know? And so it's the same way that I always said that Black folk in Berkshire County, no matter where they live, North or South, we know each other, you know, we may not have ever met, but we know you, we know about you. And so that's how he got the message is through communication with this friend of his that knew someone in Pittsfield. He came, gave his inaugural sermon to the church. The church liked him, and then they called him to preach. And so this is his first, you know, real ministry here. And what Reverend Harrison does is he starts to really become the minister. The congregation was always small at Second Congregational Church, but he served all the Blacks in the community in that when anybody wanted to get married, if you go back and you look at, you know, the marriage records of Blacks during the 19th century, Harrison was the one that married them, whether they lived in Sheffield or whether they lived in North Adams. Harrison was the one because he was the only Black minister, and the Second Congregation was the only Black church at that point in period of time. Finally, we're going to get, you know, more Black churches popping up and stuff like that. But even when those Black churches pop up, they don't have a resident minister. They usually would have a traveling minister, someone who would come for one or two Sundays or stuff like that. Harrison lived in the community, and everybody knew he lived in the community. And so they said, okay, even though we don't belong to Second Congregational, we want this black man to marry us, you know. And so he became really important to the Berkshire community, not only for the black community, but the white community as well knew him. He knew everybody from the president of Williams College to the governor of the state. And that is how he got his call to be the chaplain of the Massachusetts 54th. The governor took the train from Boston out to the Berkshires to see the widow of the leader who kind of ran the 54th. He was killed. Of course, we know that because you've seen the movie.
Yeah,
Everybody's seen that movie.
Glory.
Glory. Everybody's seen Glory. Robert Gould Shaw's.
Yeah.
Robert Gould Shaw's wife actually came from Lenox, and her name was Annie Haggerty. And Annie, governor was coming up to give his condolences to Annie Haggerty because of Shaw's, because Shaw was killed. On his way, he asked Harrison to meet him at the train station in Pittsfield
Yeah.
because he wanted to ask Harrison to go down and actually, do a kind of a religious service for the remainder of the 54th. Harrison said okay because he had recruited black men to join the 54th. He and Frederick Douglass, I mean, he knew Frederick Douglass, and Frederick Douglass had recruited Harrison to be a kind of an agent to recruit others to it. And so he went down and he stayed a couple of months, came back, and then the governor asked him to really be the official chaplain. And as a chaplain of the 54th, that was an officer position, right? And so officers made more money than the enlisted men, like $13 for the enlisted men versus almost $20 for officers, right? Well, when Harrison got down there, the black enlisted men were not getting paid. They wanted to pay the black enlisted men less than they did the white enlisted man. And of course, they wanted to pay Harrison less also. And so all of them said, no, no way. Harrison wrote to the governor. The governor wrote to to Abraham Lincoln. And indeed, 2 years later, at the end of the war, everybody got their pay, but they had to really, really, fight for that. And so that's one of the that's one of the things that we know Harrison for, is his fight for equal pay for black soldiers. But his sermons talk about the abolitionist kind of thing. Before the end of the Civil War, he was giving sermons about getting rid of enslavement everywhere, so he gave these fiery sermons about these kinds of things. He traveled, all around the New England, as well as he was back in Philadelphia and New
Was it
York and
safe to do that? Was it safe to when, in the confine, let's say within Massachusetts, it could have been different, but was it safe to do all this traveling and did he have to, when he's given these speeches, do it in a clandestine manner?
I don't think so. Not to his congregation. He gave it to his congregation. And when he traveled, he would be traveling to give speeches mostly to black congregations, black organizations. Although he did give a talk at Williams College, to a crowd there. And so he would kind of go any place that anybody asked him to kind of go. But we must we must understand that, Massachusetts had gotten rid of, was supposedly, free. There were no slavery in Massachusetts. And although, and there was lip service given, like, slavery should be abolished. And so he was very, very supported in these kinds of ways. And he, I mean, he, the, he went down to South Carolina With the 54th, but that was during the war. And so he was fairly safe in that he did not go into any kind of battles. You know, the greatest battles were before he actually was down serving as chaplain. Yeah.
Because at Fort Sumter, that's when they really suffered a lot of casualties.
Casualties, yes. But those casualties were faced before he went down.
Right. Also,
but there was more fighting going on. But soldiers suffered from lack of food and lack of clothing and all of those kinds of things. In fact, Harrison was became ill and had to come back home because, you know, he had dysentery. And there was just no way that they could kind of deal with it. And so he had to come back home to cook. You know, he had like seven children at home. And so, you know, his wife, I mean, the church wasn't paying him any salary.
Right.
He was a cobbler, so he couldn't, he didn't get that salary. The army wasn't giving him a salary. His wife was a seamstress, but that wasn't bringing in enough money for the family in that kind of way. And so he really needed to get back home to kind of take care of his family as well. So.
And the home that he has that we currently know, which is right on what, first, right?
Third.
I always, why do I say first? I always do that. I don't know where I get first from. I don't know where I'm getting first from. Third. I have to like get that out of my mind. But it's a beautiful little house. It's so charming.
Yeah.
And it's nestled right in our downtown area.
Yeah.
And to know he was always there, right?
He was always there because remember the first church of Second Congregation was on First Street.
Ah, okay.
So he walked from his house on Third Street through the common.
Okay.
Where the old Rainbow Restaurant was.
Yes, let's say, exactly.
That's where the church was located. And
yes.
So during his time as minister for Second Congregational, that's where the church was.
That's where I keep getting first from.
Right.
I'm like, I know I'm getting this somewhere and I kept mixing up the two.
The church was on First Street. And
okay.
So he was right there in the heart of Pittsfield where he could walk down to his church and then he could walk uptown or downtown. And there are a lot of stories. The Black community in Pittsfield decided that they were not going to have any slave catchers come to Pittsfield.
Mm.
And so they, so one weekend, somebody came to his house and said, you know, there was a slave catcher in town. And Harrison said he, you know, got on his clothing and stuff like that and left the house, went down to this hotel, which was, on North Street at that point in time, went down there and he was going to confront this man. And of course he did confront this man. And found out that this man was a famous abolitionist. So it was not a slave catcher, but he was ready to be there. So he and the congregation had decided that they were not going to take anybody out of Pittsfield because Pittsfield was known at that point in time as a hub for escaped slaves, you know, actually coming into the area because Connecticut and New York were still, slavery wasn't abolished in those states. And so slaves would come through Pittsfield going north to the Canadian border. Some even stayed in the area, you know. And he tells another story about an actual slave catcher who comes. This is a slave owner from New York State. He comes into town looking for his escaped slave, and it was a woman. And so this one hotel in Pittsfield was known for hiring, escaped slaves.
Yeah.
And so the man asked about his slave, and the owner said no. Somebody had tipped him off that the guy was in town. So he sent the woman, the young woman, he sent her to Lanesboro and told her to go and stay in Lanesboro so she would not be in the hotel. So, he was there and the man was carrying on and the owner said, no, she's not there and anything like that. So a group, you know, kind of formed, you know, and said, well, you know, I don't know. He told him, the owner told him, I don't know what, you know, you understand this is a rough town. And, you know, if they know that you're here looking for slaves, I wouldn't, you know, put my life on the line. And this man, hurry up. And left town, you know. So Harrison tells this story, as well. So he was very, you know, up with all of the politics that was happening in the town for anybody that had anything to do with African Americans at that town. So
that side of Reverend Harrison, because I think there's a tendency to talk more about the intellectual. Mm-hmm. You know, the great traits that he has in that respect, and they're great, but also that he was no nonsense.
No, right. I know he was no nonsense. And he really believed, as a Christian, as a human being in human rights, mm-hmm. and civil rights. And he really kind of fought for that. So he was an early person to kind of to do that. See, our time is going on, and so I wanted to mention the other two before we kind of
leave.
The fourth, of course, is James Vanderzee, who we know we talk less about than the other three, right? And as I was saying to somebody, as a historian, I look at this historically, you know, enslavement with Elizabeth Freeman, the Revolutionary War with Agrippa Hall, the Civil War with Reverend Harrison, and then the Harlem Renaissance with James Vanderzee. And Vanderzee learned how to, you know, he got his first camera when he was here in the Berkshires, and really started to take some really beautiful pictures of his family, mm-hmm. as well as some people at the hotel that he and his relatives worked at. And so that's some of his early work. He really wanted to be a violinist. Was great on the violin, and so he went to New York to join his father and his brothers, but ended up working in restaurants with them. But he just so happened to run up on this guy in Newark who had a camera shop, and this guy taught him to develop and all this kind of stuff. So that's how he used his hobby of the camera with developing and everything. And so his kind of career took off. And so when the Harlem Renaissance came around, I mean, now we look at a lot of the photographs of the Harlem Renaissance and, you know, we call them Vanderzees. They're Vanderzees, you know, and to think that this young boy, you know, started right in the Berkshires, you know.
Yes.
And his family also owned property in Lenox. They had what is called kind of a family compound there, you know, because there were like two or three other relatives who kind of lived there and worked there. And but they were always in the kind of catering business and that kind of way, in the way that they kind of did it. His home has been destroyed, but one of his relatives and aunt, that house mm-hmm. still stands right off of 7, you know, they put in that 7 bypass. And of course, his house was probably right there where 7 was. And so that house was destroyed, but the aunt's house is still there.
And Dr. Jones Sneed, what's that other, what's the last name before we run out of time? I want you to get that last name in. What's the next person?
Of course, the last name has to be W.E.B. Du Bois, who I talk about all the time. Which I spent less time talking about. And of course, W.E.B. Du Bois is civil rights, of course. And, you know, I call him the father of the modern civil rights movement, because Du Bois, of course, was one of the founders of the NAACP. Before the NAACP, he had founded with William Monroe Trotter, the Niagara Movement. And if you look at the Niagara Movement, you'll see that some of the same tenets that they talked about in the Niagara Movement is the same ones that the NAACP, accepted. So Du Bois, because he lived so long, not only civil rights, he was in the Harlem Renaissance, he was in the peace movement. It goes on and on. But from the very, very start, as a small boy in Great Barrington, Du Bois knew that he was somebody. And, even when he writes his first letter back home to his mother, I mean, you knew that this kid was somebody. He starts when he's like 14 or 15 being a correspondent to Black newspapers about the political situation in Great Barrington. I mean, who thinks, graduated as the valedictorian of his high school class, the only Black in his class, and he was a valedictorian. Who thinks of these kinds of things? If you read his autobiography, he understood, and his mother understood, that he was a special, special person. And so to from Du Bois, to Elizabeth Freeman, we look at those five, and then 500 others that we just kind of, we call them ordinary folks like us,
Right. And
but
what
they
can
are
we
all.
take from these ordinary folks, Dr. Jones Snead? What lessons can we take from them as we wrap up?
I think that we can take from them that that we all, and I'm going to include us, and that we all, as Blacks who live in the Berkshires, kind of understand who we are, and we have this grit about us, that we're going to kind of make it and make some kind of impact on the society in which we live in order to make it better, not only for ourselves, but for others, And I think that that's what goes through it. So you look at Dorothy Amos, who was there in the 1960s in Pittsfield, who started the first, preschool for kids,
Kids.
which is now 18, which is the same organization as now 18 Degrees.
Yes.
How did this woman, figure this kind of way? Harrison's descendants, became a visiting nurse. Florence Edmonds became the only Black visiting nurse. Stephanie Wilson becomes, the second or third Black woman who goes into space. We can just keep on throwing out these stories. So, there are just hundreds of these stories that we can just tell, which is just so fascinating. And so these five kind of markers that we talk about historically, they are then filtered with all of these other stories. You filter down to all these other stories coming into the 21st century.
Yes, ordinary people doing extraordinary things
Extraordinary things.
that we
Yes. Yeah.
continue to speak about to this day.
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Joan Sneed. I love traveling, taking a trip down history's path. And I think that history is there for all of us to learn about, and to get great lessons from. There's so much in history that we can learn and grow from. And so I thank you for painting this wonderful picture of individuals who have led lives with bravery, strength, courage, and resilience. And I thank you so much for it. It's been a pleasure having you on for part two. Thank you so much for just giving me this time to have this conversation. And I just really appreciate it. So thank you. Thank you so much. To my listeners, you've been listening today to Backstory. Let's hear it on WTBR Pittsfield with Roberta McCulloch-Dews. And I just want to thank you, and I hope you have a great day.